Well, before we get into Nehemiah, you won't find this on your outline, but Galatians. There's something that has been... we've read this verse recently on Sunday morning, but I have been going back to it in my mind often, even considering the labor that we do here and thinking about Turkey, just in general, our service of the Lord. I didn't tell you where, did I? Galatians 6, 7, just the next couple of verses there. This is, it always impacts me what the kids are doing, you know. It always seems to flow over. I'm sure it flows both ways. But, just reading this verse and for what it is a promise. And, a promise to us. And so, I just want to choose to believe this promise. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. There's the negative end of a promise. And then the positive end of a promise. The one who sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. And here, this is the one I was really focused on, this part. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. That we should not grow tired of investing in God's work. And there's a guarantee if we don't give up in doing that, that we will reap a harvest. And you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't know what that completely means. You know, I don't know that means that we'll see how much of that harvest that we'll see with our eyes on this earth. I don't really know. But I do know that our service, our investment in the kingdom will not go unrewarded. I know that we will reap a harvest because that's what it says. I don't understand exactly when or how. I know we have to be patient because it says to persevere in it. So, I don't know. That's just been on my mind this morning that to not grow weary, to persevere in doing what God has called us to do right here in Utah. So, although I do think Nehemiah is a good example in not growing weary and continuing even with great opposition, which we will, is where we are again today. In Nehemiah chapter 5. So, last week, the last couple of weeks, we've been a little bit into the opposition that Nehemiah faced. And, you know, Nehemiah wouldn't have had this opposition if he hadn't taken on the project of building the wall. If he hadn't taken on with intensity and purpose to do God's will, he would not have had the same kind of opposition that he was having. But before he took this on, you see, Nehemiah's disposition, his attitude, was what allowed him even to be able to see there was a project that needed to be done, that there was an investment that needed to be made. Because Nehemiah, that you can see when he heard about the condition of the wall, it concerned him greatly. And I know we keep going back to this, but I see this as a core theme. That does the condition of the wall concern us? Does the condition of the lost concern us? Does the condition of the body concern us? The condition of other believers? And Nehemiah's response that he wept, he fasted, and he prayed for God's purposes. And then we looked up in 1 Corinthians 3, 9 through 15 about a direct correlation there with building up the body. With we can make that direct correlation to the wall. And then where Jesus had corrected Peter, where he said, "You have in mind the things of man and not the things of God." And as we read through this, as we study this, we must look at ourselves and say, do we have in mind the things of man or the things of God? You know, you can approach even the church, building the kingdom, you can approach that with the things of man in mind. That's what Peter was doing. He had in mind the kingdom. but really had in mind his own selfish ambition and motivation. That's why Jesus corrected him there. And then Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me. And it can be tough to have this eternal perspective. But this is to be at the core of us, is not to be our own purpose, but to be God's purpose, to have in mind the things of God. And in one sense, the bad news is, when you do that, you're asking for trouble. There will be opposition. But the good news is that by faith, we can overcome that opposition. And we'll have intimacy with Him in doing that. So last week, we looked at this kind of, we looked at the opposition, and then we looked at Nehemiah, just trying to learn from his example. We identified the opposition, and then we identified Nehemiah's response. And so there's a couple of chapters here of that just talk about opposition. So I'm ready to leave behind the teaching on opposition, but we have at least, if we get through this today, this is the last one. And then we'll move on to what happens next, which is basically revival within the city of Jerusalem there. So that's what we'll do again today. We'll start with opposition like we did last week. Remember, we would identify something like syncretism, anger that God's work was being done, or discouragement, the attacks. And then we would look at Nehemiah's response. So we'll just start with that. We'll use that same method here this morning. So we'll start with chapter 5, and we'll just work through these two chapters in that same fashion. Verses 1 through 5, we'll look at the, try to identify the opposition here. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous in order for us, and are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards, our homes to get grain during the famine. Still others were saying, we have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards, although we are the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. So what was going on here is some of the Jewish countrymen, brothers, were acting, they were on the inside, but they were acting like opposition. They were opposing God's work, but they were on the inside. This was not an attack from the outside, it was an attack from the inside. And they were having success at discouraging the builders of the wall, even more success possibly than the attacks from the outside. The people were getting discouraged. You can tell from the way, when you read through that, these are the builders talking here, and they're discouraged. And what's going on here is that they're spending all their time and their energy, they're working on building this, building the wall. And this other group of Jews are taking advantage of them. They need food to eat. They need money to live. And so they're loaning them money, but they're doing it at an exorbitant interest rate, which was a common practice in that day in other nations. 50% interest rate sometimes they would charge. Now, the Jews were not to charge each other interest. They could charge interest to foreigners, and they were not to charge exorbitant, no matter what they were not to, but they were not to charge interest rate to each other. They were to loan freely among one another. And so they saw this opportunity, and a group were taking advantage of them. And there seems to be a point in this, is that these Jews that were doing this were self-focused. They were looking after their own needs above everyone else. And I believe these are the same nobles from chapter 3, remember, who were not helping with the work. Remember, we identified that group of nobles. They refused to help with the work. So it's kind of like a progression. Their selfishness showed back there, and now it's been progressing, and now it's become full-blown, and they're taking advantage and growing rich off of their neighbors. And we cannot underestimate the damage that a self-focus will do to the body. Now, it doesn't always go to this extent, but unchecked, it will go to this extent. A self-focus unchecked, And we've talked about this a lot over the years, is to be sure and identify that self-focus and get rid of it. And this is a good example of it. It was a self-focus unchecked. And it doesn't always go this far, but any self-focus, one person being self-focused in the body, always causes damage. It always, always causes damage. If it stays in that mode, it will do great damage. The reason, and the really bad part about this, is the reason that their brothers were disadvantaged and they could be taken advantage of in the first place was they were putting so much into the wall. And the opposition would never have come with this much intensity if there wasn't a sacrifice going on for the wall building. There wouldn't have been that opportunity to take advantage. So, in the body even, what we see is that when there's sacrifice, when people really are making sacrifices to invest in the kingdom, it actually brings opportunity, even within the body, for opposition and self-focus. That's just, those are the games that Satan plays. So that's our, I guess our take-home lesson from that opposition. It was an inside job, and it was a self-focus. That was the opposition they received. And here's the response that Nehemiah gives. Here again, we have, it's on your outline there, you can kind of look ahead to see where we're going with it. He got mad. He confronted, and he used his own personal life example to in his confronting of them, and then he looked to God for assurance. So let's read those verses 6-8. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury. You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. You see, Nehemiah had, when all this had started, there were some that were already enslaved because they were so poor. And Nehemiah, with his own money, had purchased them out of slavery, had purchased their freedom. Obviously, Nehemiah had some money. He had this high position of cupbearer to the king. And he used his own personal money to purchase them out so that they could come and do God's work. And then his own countrymen had enslaved them again, re-enslaved them. And so you can see why Nehemiah would be pretty upset about what's going on here. When their self-centeredness extended to the point of opposition to the body and opposition to the sacrificial work of God, then the body needs to respond and leadership needs to step up. And that's what Nehemiah did. He stepped up. He saw this opposition. He needed to intervene. And that's what he did. He confronted them. Let's go to this 2 Corinthians 11, 2-3. Just hold your finger there in Nehemiah because we'll be right back. You see, we really have, we underestimate Christ's love for the body and his disdain for division. Now, if you think, well, if he hates division so much, then why was Nehemiah so hard on him to cause more division? No, he disdains compromise even more. To bring true unity is not the lowest common denominator. It's bringing everybody in line with the truth. So true unity, to get to true unity, sometimes will take the appearance of division. But division in the body, Christ hates. Division means that people following their own way and not the way of the head of Jesus. So let's take a quick look at this, 11, 2 and 3. This is Paul talking here. "I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ." And Carlton mentioned a verse this morning that's not in your outline, but 2 Timothy 2:10, where Paul's saying, "I endure all things for the sake of the elect." Paul was protective of the body. Any harm done, whether that's harm through bad doctrine, whether that's harm through rumors or gossip, any harm done to the body, Paul stepped up and dealt with it strongly. And you see a similar situation when Jesus was clearing the temple. What was going on there was that people were taking advantage. You see, poor people were coming in, they had traveled, and they had to buy sacrifice, you know, animals to sacrifice in the temple. And so that's what they were doing. They were selling this stuff in the temple. They were taking advantage of the poor people in the temple. They were part of the body, if you want to translate that to modern day, was taking advantage of another. They're looking out for their own selfish interest. That's at the core of what Jesus was doing there when he was clearing the temple. What should have been God's house, where there's unity and worship, there was division. And Jesus got angry. He didn't like what was going on there. And we already use this other example where, remember, Peter was adding to the gospel. He was adding works to the gospel. And it had the potential to destroy the body. Paul got mad. It said he got in Peter's face. He got angry. Nehemiah confronts them, and he is angry. It's not because of some personal affront that he's angry or hurt feelings, but he was angry because God's people were being harmed. You see, because the only way he could have appropriate anger here, if his whole attitude was right from the beginning, that he had God's purposes at his core and at his heart, and if he was living for God's purposes, not his own, then he could have appropriate anger. And he did. And then he uses personal examples that the people have seen how he's lived, such as what we just talked about, buying his own people out of slavery. So let's see how, let's look briefly here at how they responded. Back to Nehemiah, chapter 5, verses 9 through 12. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the 100th part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. So they responded. There's no guarantee that people will respond well to appropriate confrontation, but these guys did respond. They set aside their personal needs and desires for the sake of the call. And that is the need of our day, because we are bombarded with our own personal needs and desires. Bombarded. And until we can set aside for the sake of the call, for the sake of the call to go and make disciples, for the sake of the call to please God and not ourselves, then we must be able to set aside our personal needs and desires for that. And let's go to verse 16. And this really reveals the attitude of Nehemiah's heart. We'll skip a few verses there where he's making them promise and putting a curse on them if they don't stick with it. Verse 16. "Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land." Nehemiah was setting the example here. He set aside personal needs and desires for the sake of the call. Don't you think that Nehemiah would have liked to have had some land in Jerusalem? Nehemiah loved Jerusalem. He had a love for the city, a love for the people, to be near the temple. Don't you think, and at these prices, the market was right. At these prices, wouldn't he love to have had some land? And all the men that were with him, wouldn't they have liked to purchase land? But it would have interfered with the work on the wall. So it wasn't wrong for them. It wouldn't have been wrong for them to purchase land at the right time and that. But for the sake of the call, they set aside their personal desires, Nehemiah and all of his men. And they put God's purposes first. You know, when you look at this, you have to, You know, someone might be tempted to say here, well, couldn't Nehemiah have been a little more loving here? And it's like, does Nehemiah's anger make you a little uncomfortable here? If it does, then you have to consider, how uncomfortable are you going to be when you see the wrath of God poured out on all those who have rejected the Son? Now, I'm not defending anger. Most of the time, myself, all of us included, our anger is probably because someone has hurt us in some kind of way, or took advantage of us, and so we get angry. That's the way we are. But that was not Nehemiah's attitude. He had a righteous anger. And one day, we may get a glimpse of the righteous anger of God as He deals with those who have rejected the Son. Nehemiah was angry over the attack on God's people, not a personal attack or rejection. That's important to note. Down to verse 19. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people. You know, Nehemiah didn't look to man for his reassurance. He looked to God. Nehemiah, as we've been talking here, he put it all on the line. He gave up his life for the sake of the call. His job, his finances, his time, and even taking on the emotional strain of having a love for God's people. You know, that's an emotional strain, to have a love for God's people, because when those people reject God and God's purposes, it hurts the person that has a love for God's people. So he's taking on, he's given up his life, he's taking on this emotional strain of the love for God's people, like Paul, like we just talked about with Paul, had a jealousy for the church, an appropriate thing, and it hurt Paul when they rejected the love of Christ. So Nehemiah here saying that it hurt, you know, it hurts when I see you not taking on what God's called you to do. And so you can see, when you take on God's purposes like this, there may be moments where you say, uh-oh, I've given all this up. I've taken all this on. And it's not working. It's not working. Where are the results of this sacrifice? It's not working. And you can kind of feel that a little bit, Nehemiah. But he doesn't turn to man for his reassurance and say, is it working? What I'm doing is working. He turns to God. And he says, you see it, don't you, God? You see it, don't you? I've poured my life out here. You see it, don't you, God? And you get this feel that God reassures him and comforts him that you will reap a harvest. It will. You will. Persevere. Keep going. And you kind of get this feel from Nehemiah as he turns to God. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Another attack. It just keeps coming. They just keep rolling in waves, the attacks here. This one is going to be scheming and distraction. Classic attacks of the enemy. When word came to Sanballat, you remember Sanballat and Tobiah, they were Samaritans, governors of other little provinces around there. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies when word came to them that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message, come let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. Now, here again, Nehemiah just wasn't a loving and compromising and gentle guy, was he? Wouldn't have been just a loving thing to do? What's our term today? Inclusive thing to do? To go and meet with those guys? They just wanted to talk to him. Why couldn't he just go meet with them? Wouldn't that be the sensitive thing to do for him? But you see, he knew. He called it like it was. They mean to do me harm. And they mean to stop the Lord's work. And I'm not toying with it. I'm not going to toy with it. I'm not going to become distracted. I know what I'm doing. I know what God has called me to. And I'm going to keep on doing what He's called me to do. And you have to remember who's behind this attack. This is not just men against Nehemiah. Satan is behind this attack. What if Satan, through these guys, can get Nehemiah to go to this meeting? You could use this. Meetings can just be a waste of time, right? If Satan can be successful in this and get him to waste his time going to this meeting, he has distracted him from God's purpose. He's just distracted him. Got him going in a whole other direction. Compromise will be the next step. But Nehemiah doesn't give in to this. Verses 3 and 4. Chapter 6. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I'm carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave and go down to you? Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. He didn't give in. He had a vision for God's work. He had a vision that what he was doing was eternal in nature. So, he said, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep going at it. And the attack was relentless. He had a vision for how important this work was that he was doing. And even though the attack was relentless, four times they kept coming with the same thing. They were not giving up. And then they're going to try a different tactic. Verses 5 and 6. Then the fifth time Sanballat sent his aid to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter. Now, we've studied this before. Remember from Revelation, when a letter came in those days, it was rolled up, and then it would have a seal on it, and then the insignia would be on that of whoever had the authority to open that letter. Like if it was a letter to the king, then it would have his insignia on it, and then you better have authority to open that letter. But this letter was open, like whatever's in here is common knowledge. Everybody knows it. So, with that in mind, this is what the letter said. It is reported among the nations everywhere, Nehemiah, and Geshem says it is true. Geshem says it's true. It must be true. That you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and they've even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king. So come, let us confer together. So, here it is. He's warning. This is common knowledge. Everybody knows about it. They know what you're doing there. You just want to be king, Nehemiah. You just want to have power. And this is going to get back to your friend, the king. Nehemiah is loyal to the king. This is his friend. He loves the king. But now when the king hears this kind of stuff, what's the king's response going to be? Hey, this guy told me he's going back there to build a wall, to build up the spiritual condition of the city. Now he's wanting to take over and give me competition? You know Nehemiah. That's got to hurt. He doesn't want the king to think like that about him. So the attack here is rumors, lies, and intimidation. Don't think this doesn't go on. This happens. When you take on the cause of Christ, these things happen. And if you don't come to our meeting, this is what's going to happen. You see, they add a little punch to the request. If you don't come to our little meeting, this word might possibly somehow get back to the king. And on top of that, the religious leaders, the prophets, will be against you. You don't want to have the religious leaders against you. Come to our little meeting. Let's see what Nehemiah's response is. Verses 8 and 9. I sent him this reply. Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your own head. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed. Now strengthen my hands. So, first he defended the truth. Sometimes we think it's not okay to defend the truth. He defended the truth. He says, you're lying. What you're saying is not true. You're making it up. That's not what I'm doing. And then he prayed. God, strengthen her. He wouldn't have prayed that if he wasn't feeling, I think Nehemiah was feeling a little weak. Maybe a little sick to his stomach. You know that feeling you get? Oh, everybody's going to know. Everybody's going to think this about me. Oh, no. Strengthen my hands, oh God. Strengthen. He turned to God. He defended the truth. You guys are lying. But then he turns to God. Strengthen our hands, oh God, that we will complete the work. He prayed. Down to verse 10. The next attack. This one is, they keep getting more and more personal and painful. This is his friend. He's going over to his friend's house. One day I went to the house of, you have to look that up in your little voice identification there, Ken, see if you can pronounce that. Shemaiah. Shemaiah. Okay. I like mine better. Son of Deliah, son of Methabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple and let us choose the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you. So what's going on here? He's going to his friend's house. His friend says, I've heard a plot. Guys are after you. They're on your trail. They're coming to the city right now. They could be breaking in the door any minute. They're coming and they're going to kill you. The only safe place you need to go, let's run to the temple. Go. Go to the temple now. They're after you. And Nehemiah answers him. No, I will not go. You see, you remember that who was allowed to go into the holy places of the temple? Who could go into the holy places? The priest. Was Nehemiah a priest? He was not a priest. He was a leader, but he was not a priest. Can a man like myself go in there? I cannot. You see, this man was his friend, he thought, but he immediately knew this was opposition. How did he know this was opposition to God's work? The guy was asking him to do something against Scripture. And he didn't have to think about it. He didn't have to say, oh, are you... He knew. He said, no, I'm not going. I'm not going to do it. You're my enemy. I thought you were my friend. I'm not going along with this. I'm going to follow God and not you. That was a tough one. But yet, it should have been clear, and it was clear to Nehemiah. He was feeling the pressure of a friend to save his own hide. Yet, he knew immediately that it was an attack because this guy was asking to be disobedient to God. So, a test of opposition. Are the ones trying to influence you, are they tempting you to be disobedient in your walk? Or are they disobedient in their walk? That's a test to see if it's real opposition. If whoever's trying to influence you, what's their walk look like? Is there disobedience? Then they're probably influencing you to the wrong and their opposition to God's cause. Or if they're influencing something to you for you to do that is questionable, then they're probably opposition. What I mean is opposition. They're not just doing something in ignorance, giving you just bad counsel. They are opposition. They're being used to oppose God's purpose. That's a good test. It's a quick test. You can just run it through your mind when you experience that. And if you're out doing God's purpose, you can just pack these things away because you'll need to unpack them someday. You'll need this. Okay. 11 through 14. I've already told you basically, but we'll look at Nehemiah's response. But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. He's stern. He's strong. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. And then verse 14, he prays, "Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me." He refused to give in to fear. He refused to be a coward. He refused to give in to fear, and he refused to give in to temptation. You see, if they could get him to disobey God, then they would discredit him in front of the people, and then the people wouldn't listen to him, and then the work on the wall would stop. So the opposition was temptation, tempting him to sin against God. Now, isn't that crazy that opposition is using the very principles of God against, we'll get this guy to sin, then he won't be in favor with God or the people, so yeah, let's just get him, it's crazy. But that's what they were doing. They were trying to get him to sin. He spoke the truth directly, and he prayed, and he passed the test. This was a test. You know, we don't always know it's a test because things get foggy under pressure. Don't you know it was a little foggy in the room? He was in this guy's home. This was a friend of his. The guy was faking concern for him. Have you ever had that feeling? This concern is not genuine. This is their control. This is manipulation. I think that was Nehemiah's going, this guy's acting like he's concerned about me, but this feels like manipulation. And then the guy says, run to the temple. He said, it was manipulation. No, this guy is opposing God's purposes. He passed the test. Verses 15 through 19. Wow. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. That is a nearly impossible task, by the way. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Also, in those days of the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under the oath to him, since he was the son-in-law. Anyway, they kept on with some opposition, but yet the wall had been completed. And the people knew that this was God's doing. They acknowledged to themselves that, all this opposition, this tremendous task, these weak people, and they did it. They knew that it had been God, and they backed off for the time being, anyway. But you see, Nehemiah was willing to take on a job that could only be done in the strength of God and at great personal cost. He knew this from the onset. This was an impossible job. He knew from the onset it would be at great personal cost to him. Yet, he was willing to take it on. And you see, God was going to get glory in it because they were too weak to do it without God. Yet God did it, and everybody knew that God had done it. And God got the glory. But for that to happen, Nehemiah had to be willing to take on this impossible task. But when you read on here, the battle is not over. And Nehemiah, you got to just admire the guy. He doesn't give in to the temptation of the flesh. You know, after success is sometimes the weakest moment. After success, you just want to kick back and just watch whatever comes to your mind, whatever happens to be on TV with no discretion. You just want to relax. I just deserve this. I've worked hard. I'm just going to give into the flesh for a little while. I'm going to eat some chocolate and watch whatever I want on TV. Just give into it. But Nehemiah didn't do that. He stayed alert because he knew the attack would keep coming. And if you read on there, you'll see that the battle is not over. That when the wall is complete, but he tells them, don't open the gates till the sun is high in the sky. And you close the gates when it's still early, even if it costs us financially. because they're still coming after us. We want the gates to only be open in broad daylight while we're all alert. He's saying, stay alert, because the attack is, and that's the way it is for us. The battle is not over in this life. If you're looking for a season of retirement, you're not going to find it. The battle is not over in this life. We have to stay on the alert until the end. We have to finish strong. And that's what we see Nehemiah doing. Although he's not done yet. Next week, we'll take a look at the revival that follows. And it's the first instance I'm absolutely, is really clear where there are small group Bible studies going on in this next little, as a part of this revival that's coming up. Pretty interesting stuff. But we'll get to that next time.